This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Reporter Frank Langfitt was no stranger to China when he took a job as NPR's Shanghai correspondent in 2011. He'd worked for a newspaper in Beijing for 5 years, starting in the mid-90s. But the country he returned to on his new assignment was vastly different from the one he left behind. Growth had slowed, corruption had increased, and the rise of social inequality was palpable. As Frank started to report on what he saw, he found that his stories were missing the heart and the depth that he craved. So he comes up with a very creative idea. He offers free taxi rides in exchange for authentic conversation. The stories and insight he picked up along the way are documented in a new book, The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Frank Langfitt joins me now. Frank, welcome. Good to see you. How are you doing?
Happy to be here. Thanks for having me, Frank.
This book, let's take one half step back. It comes out at a particularly interesting time in U.S.-China relations.
Not one that I saw. I started driving the taxi cab in 2014 when President Trump wasn't even running and Xi Jinping was, I guess, a couple of years in office.
So talk about this desire you had and this feeling you had that you weren't really getting into hearts and minds.
Well, I thought what I wanted to do at the time was really see from the perspective of ordinary Chinese what they made of what was happening in China and China's place in the world. And what I had learned back, I grew up in Philadelphia. And when I got out of college, I actually couldn't get a job in journalism, so I drove a taxi cab. And I found from that experience that I met all kinds of people in Philadelphia I never would have met and went to places I'd never seen. And so I tried basically that same model in Shanghai. And that way, you're able to meet a wide variety of people. And instead, you know, it's not an easy place to report on in China because of the politics and a bit of the culture. And this allowed me the opportunity to just sort of chat with people in a very neutral environment and in the safety of a taxi cab. And then I followed the most interesting characters for the next 4 or 5 years.
Talk about that cultural difference, because, you know, that's the job of a reporter,
right?
Really, get into hearts and minds, and you're good at that. But is it harder in China than
other
places?
It's much harder, yeah. And it's even harder since I left. It's now very difficult for a lot of my colleagues. And to give you a great example, your radio guy, I almost never would use a microphone in China on the street. If you pull out a microphone, people uncomfortable. So I usually would use a recorder with a very good internal microphone and to catch that. And then when I was in the cab, once I got to know a passenger quite well, I would often drive them to appointments or back and forth to work. And I would have mic them and we would just drive for 50 minutes or an hour and just chat.
I want to talk about some of these people you met, amazing characters, tremendous stories. But first of all, driving a cab, getting a shield, no, getting a medallion in Shanghai, not an easy thing
for
an American.
It was not even possible. And so I had this idea from my old experience, and the question is, how do you execute it? So I actually went to, I had some cab driver friends who were very nice, and I went to some cab companies, and they just laughed at me. They said, this is not New York City. Foreigners don't drive cabs here. And so then actually with my news assistant, a guy who lived in Shanghai and worked for me, his idea was make it free because you won't be violating the law. They can't legally pull you over for this because you're not harming anybody. You're not taking money. And so we figured a way to, my wife had the idea, Julie, to put these magnetic signs on the car and in Mandarin saying, looking for making friends in Shanghai, learning about Shanghai life in exchange for a free ride. And people seemed to understand it, and it wasn't that hard to pick up passengers.
That's interesting, too, because I would think, stay away from that guy.
No, and you're right. And Frank, when I first, like the first night, it took me like 2 weeks to get the guts up to unroll my magnetic signs and put it on my rented Camry and go out on a Saturday night in the rain. And I wasn't sure anybody would get in the cab, and I was very nervous. And then, you know, Shanghainese people, they know a good deal when they see it. And also Chinese are incredibly curious. And so the idea that there was some middle-aged white guy driving around a free cab, they thought, how harmful can he be? And they jumped in the cab and off we went.
Did the conversations start off right away? Did it take you time?
Immediately. And what was great about this, and again, I didn't anticipate this. It's just like you do an experiment and you see how it plays out. What was really nice is that they would get in the cab and they would start interviewing me. So instead of them feeling like, oh, here's a Western reporter, he's going to ask a lot of questions and kind of extract information, they were the ones who said, is this your real job? How bad is the economy in America that you have to be doing this? Things like that.
You just told them about the pay scale at NPR and the whole thing was cleared up, right?
So that's kind of, sometimes they were confused initially. And early on, I didn't know the city that well. So I would actually get lost and drive people to the wrong side of the river. But they were very polite. And they sort of figured, you know, for free, they couldn't expect very much in terms of service as long as I eventually got them to the destination. So it was also, the beginning was quite humbling.
Tell us about some of the people you met. First, tell us about Ashley.
Well, Ashley was really, really interesting. I've gotten to know her for quite some time. And what I found interesting about her is she moved to the United States because she was tired of the corruption, as you were mentioning at the beginning, as well as the repression. And things have been tightening in recent years, much more so than at any time I've covered China. And she went to the United States in hope of a much freer life. And what happened was, after she'd been there about 5 months, the President Trump was elected, and she's not a fan of President Trump. She'd been a supporter of Hillary Clinton. And she saw in him, from her perspective, she put it in her words, some of the authoritarian tendencies that she had seen in the leaders in China. So she became actually quite disillusioned. And she also felt that the idea that a democracy works only if you have a well-informed electorate, she felt that was breaking down in the U.S. And so this is something, actually, she moved to, when she was in the States, I met her in Chicago. And here's how she described the way she was thinking.
10 years ago, back when I'm 18, I think a lot of thoughts about America and democracy are kind of like ideal. But the first time I came to America, which is 2014, I just start to see that ugly side of it. So I think if you were to give people power, you have to prepare for that stupidness, because most people are ignorant. That's just the truth. And they don't think in depth.
A woman named Ashley talking to my guest, NPR reporter Frank Langfitt. The two met when Frank was driving a free taxi around Shanghai. He's documented those journeys in his book, The Shanghai Free Taxi. He's going to be in conversation about that book with WUNC General Manager Connie Walker, Quail Ridge Books, this evening in Raleigh. Tell me more about Ashley, but also in general, do the people that you met in China seem to follow what's going on in the United States?
Yes, they do. And I think that this is often the case, that Chinese are far better informed. Even amid all the censorship, they are far better informed about the U.S. than we are about China, which is one of the reasons I wrote the book. And I wanted to give a voice. I mean, as you've seen in the book, there's not a lot of me in it. There doesn't need to be. These characters are very articulate. They have great context. They can explain themselves. And so that was one of the things I was trying to accomplish.
It's amazing to me to see the number of people who are concerned about the growing repression in China. Again, if you think about a country that has, you know, for much of its, much of what I know of its history, that's been the story. Then there's this opening and then a repression. What's their sense of whether things have changed? Are they sort of millennials? They didn't know it then. You know, they didn't grow up under Mao.
I think that they are aware of it. I mean, the people who are most, you know, you now have Chinese traveling all over the world. They have access to lots of things. Many of them now are quite wealthy in a way that was, I mean, unimaginable 20 years ago. I would like to make one point that I found so interesting in the book is that almost all my characters lead much better lives than their parents did. That said, there is particularly among the intelligentsia and people who'd be more liberal-minded, there is a frustration at the constricting. And really, if you think of the last 30 or 40 years, particularly the last 20 years up until recently, there was a general opening. It was easier to operate there. It was easier to get information. Under Xi Jinping, it really has changed. And you really feel like the temperature has dropped in the country, and a lot of people are aware. Now, I will say, and we have, I think these are important characters in the book, there are people who live inside what they call, you know, the Great Firewall of China that blocks the ability of people to reach websites outside the country. There are people who literally live their lives, many, the majority, live inside the wall in what is basically a Chinese intranet. And they're quite happy because all the sites are very helpful to them. And in some cases, they're not that aware of what they're missing.
Although you do talk to people who say, you know, that they don't take the semi-official Chinese website where news and information is available. It's now become a source of entertainment for many of the people.
Very much so. Yeah. And I think to understand Chinese censorship, it's quite complex and quite clever. I mean, not only do they block lots of websites, but the actual Chinese internet, which I worked on, I operated on as well, is lots of fun. It's very entertaining. And so there's also a desire here by the regime to distract people. And people, of course, they're leading very challenging lives. There's lots of competition. They would actually relate. A lot of my characters would relate to a lot of people in the United States, particularly in big cities who are competing every day and worried about healthcare and education. Mm-hmm. A lot of the same challenges, which wasn't as true under the, obviously at all, really, under communism.
Let's talk about another one of these characters, Ray. He's a Shanghai lawyer who studied in America. Tell us more about him.
He was really interesting. I met him back about 2015. I put an offer out on the internet saying that I would drive people back home for Chinese New Year, which is this massive mass migration back to the countryside. And I had done it in the 90s. And so I found I met two men and drove them back to Hubei province. It was 500 miles. Well, one of the men's brothers is this fellow Ray, who I found very, very interesting because he had studied the Constitution and he was a great fan of certain elements of the system of checks and balances here. But he's also very patriotic Chinese and really felt that the U.S. was bullying the U.S. was bullying China, especially around the South China Sea and all that island building. And this is one of the conversations that we had.
And China have a lot of resources to take care of these islands. A lot of people, a lot of countries in that time steal these islands one by one. When China want to claim his right against other countries, Americans show up. No, you cannot do this. Yeah. So just like, you know, the big boy in a class, just bully others.
Shanghai lawyer Ray talking to my guest, NPR reporter Frank Langfitt. The two met when Frank was driving a free taxi around Shanghai to try to get into the hearts and minds of the people he was covering when he was working for NPR in that city. He documented those journeys in his new book, The Shanghai Free Taxi, and he's going to be at Quail Ridge Books tonight with WNC General Manager Connie Walker. To what extent are people, do you think, because this is now becoming one giant capitalist economy, people must be getting that, and the United States, while this is not the American century anymore, certainly in a controlling position there. What's the sense of where people fit in that economic scheme and whether this is a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, I think that what's interesting about so many of these characters is they have lived through an era of growth that's unprecedented in human history. Over 30 years of, at a minimum, 6% growth, which is just astonishing. And so to put this in perspective, I remember being in Shanghai in 97, 98 when I first got to China, and there was one skyscraper going up. When I moved back in 2011, 2012, I lived in a neighborhood with three skyscrapers taller than the Empire State Building. It's just phenomenal. And I think there's a great deal of goodwill actually for the Communist Party because at least they oversaw this. And I think Chinese people are very pragmatic. And as long as they feel that things are going reasonably well economically, they will put up with a lot. And I think in part historically because they've seen a lot worse. They saw the Great Leap Forward, 36 million in a man-made famine dying. The Cultural Revolution, again, under Mao, 1.5 million people dying in that. So these days look, you know, no matter how much repression there is and how much censorship there is, they look vastly better than what life was like under Mao.
Print, we're talking about repression. Also, we haven't even begun to talk about some of the ecological degradation that's, you know, they're experiencing over there as we are here in the United States. But what about inequality? Is that something that people are concerned
about? It's huge. I mean, when I first arrived there, and I'm really glad that I've been fortunate enough to have more than 20 years, basically either living or covering the country. When I got there in 1997, there was almost no private ownership of housing. Most of my friends lived in government work apartments, and they were lousy, and they all looked the same. And by the time I left in 2002, one of my friends already owned a duplex in another house. And some of my friends were now landlords. I mean, they had a variety of properties. So that was dramatic. But what's happened is I think you really needed to make your money in China in the 2000s. That was the great opportunity to make a fortune. And it's now a lot harder. And so you do see an underclass in the cities, especially among migrants who have built these cities, migrant workers, and they really do struggle. And again, I think I live in London now. I was just in New York. You would find a lot of people who could kind of relate to feeling like, wow, I'm kind of at the bottom of the pile here. Look at these huge houses, these luxury, sports cars, things like that. Yeah, you really do feel it there in a way you didn't 20 years ago.
And the opulence is something, I mean, these are markers of success. So people are anxious to see. So you talked about your wife going to a restaurant and at one point, and, you know, there was this realizing she was just going to sit down, maybe have a drink. And it was like, well, there's a $500 table fee. Yeah, then you can order your $50 drink.
Yeah, this was at the top of one of the towers. And, of course, that was, if you went back into the 90s, that was unthinkable.
Yeah.
I mean, table charges, things, it just didn't exist.
Right. An extraordinary story here, too, because you've developed relationships with these people. And we're calling them characters, but they have become, in many ways, friends. And an extraordinary adventure you had going across the country.
Yeah. One of the things that happened is the way I approached this whole process was to just follow the characters in the story, the people where they led. And one day, I don't look at LinkedIn much, but one day I got a message from a woman in Michigan, Chinese-American woman, who wrote me, and she had actually heard about me driving these young men back to the countryside for Chinese New Year. And she wrote me and said, my little sister has gone missing in the mountains of Yunnan Province. Would you help me go look for her? I talked to her on the phone. I thought, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So I jumped on a plane and got an SUV, and off we went searching for her. And what we did is we retraced the steps of this young woman. I guess by this time she was in her 30s, who had been a prostitute and a mistress. And this is sort of, you know, much of what we've talked about so far, Frank, is how many people have led much better lives. But there are also people who can't compete as well, and they end up sort of on the darker side of this market economy, and prostitution is enormous in China. It's all over the place. And she got herself into a lot of trouble. She was trying to reinvent herself. And so we went and tracked all the way into little villages where she'd married a man. And it ended up being a very noirish and, frankly, kind of scary tale. Like, towards the end, kind of had to stop investigating because it was getting dangerous.
And she eventually did call it off.
It just became clear to us. We actually found somebody that we think definitely knew her and might have been responsible or related to people responsible for her disappearance.
That does take you into places where most reporters don't go, because your stories don't take you. What did you learn there that you might not have even learned in your
taxi ride? I think what was interesting there was I tried to make sense of that story, and I think the way I look at it is sort of the big picture. If you went back to the communist era under Mao, obviously, there were some terrible things that happened, but there was a lot of predictability much of the time, in the sense that everybody, as I was saying earlier, had the same kind of apartment, same kind of television, didn't really matter how hard you worked, that sort of thing. Yeah. The market economy has given people an opportunity to pursue dreams that were just beyond their own imaginations. At the same time, there are a lot of people who also find themselves in a very difficult position. Maybe they're not as bright. Maybe they don't have the advantages. They try to do shortcuts. And so I think the market economy has been an opportunity for people to succeed, but also an opportunity for people to fail, and in some cases, you know, fail in terrible fashion.
You staying in touch with folks?
I do. I actually was talking to, I've been in touch with Ray last week, and also was talking to Ashley last week.
Do you think this book will be published on the mainland?
No, I don't. I think that it's too candid. It's too accurate. It was not. There's quite a bit of politics in the book. It was not my intention. When I started in 2014, I wanted to write sort of a lighter travel book. But, you know, events have changed. China has changed. The relationship between the countries has changed. So particularly in the second half of the book, it's a more serious book. And I'm very candid about the problem. So I think it would be very tough to publish there right now.
Frank Langfitt, London correspondent now for NPR, also an author of the new book, The Shanghai Free Taxi, Journeys with the Hustlers and Rebels of the New China. Frank, thanks so much for being with us.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me, Frank.
Frank's going to be in conversation with WUNC General Manager Connie Walker at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tonight at 7 o'clock. We've got all the details at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, we talk about how millennial artists are keeping North Carolina's cultural traditions alive. Stay tuned.